Hello and welcome, dear listener, to another edition of the Odd Job Pod as we continue to go through the Craigs. Yes, we have reached a point where it's coincidental that we've ended up in Mexico City. You know, you might find a nice sofa there if you're looking for one to decorate your living room. Yes, we have reached a point where we are discussing Spectre. Now, this is obviously the penultimate in the Craig canon. And it's a film that I think will evoke maybe mixed emotions from the panel, certainly mixed feelings from my side. But before we do that, let me introduce you to the kites that are dancing in hurricanes, my co-hosts, Graham Sibley.
Hello.
Hello, Graham.
Hello, Gary.
Hello, and Terry DeFellin. Hello, Terry.
Hello, Gary.
Hello. And Terry, this is going to be an interesting pod because this film is so fresh in your memory, you might as well milk it from a cow.
Yeah, absolutely. I've literally, obviously not for the first time, I've seen this film more than once, but I've literally just watched it for the purpose of this podcast just now. Finished it not 20 minutes ago from when we started recording this.
And how are you feeling after that experience of Spectre?
Well, you know, I was feeling pretty down, but mercifully I've got a very handy safety net to catch me at the very last minute.
Excellent. And Graham, obviously, I know that you've been through all the Bonds. You've done, you know, you did the whole Bond set with your wife as well. And so you got to this one. How did it feel to revisit? I mean, it actually is, you know, it's nearly 10 years old now. Spectre, which was my first surprise, probably one of my few surprises for the film. How do you feel that Spectre has stood up 10 years since we saw Christoph Waltz's Crash Face appear on screen?
Well, it's been a journey, isn't it, I suppose? In fact, it only seems like yesterday, I think. I mean, it only seems a lot like yesterday that you, me and Terry went to see this film together. I think that's probably been the only time we've actually all gone to see a Bond film, I think, isn't it?
It is, alas, yeah. It's the only film that we went to see together. It was the first Bond film of the Odd Job Pod era.
Oh, was it? Was it?
Yeah, because I think we started after Skyfall.
It was around the time, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, in fairness, there have not been many James Bonds since then.
No.
So I think if it's one of only two, in which case, well, you might be right. Skyfall could have been. Anyway, yes, it was the only opportunity that we had to go and see a film together as a podcast. And before you decided to leave us, Gary, and go to Sydney.
I know. Very inconsiderate of me. I'm desperately sorry about that. You know, although I have a feeling that you still judged me more when I told you I didn't like Moonraker.
Yeah. Gary, obey the sign behind you. Good vibes only. Okay.
Yes.
Terry, that's you too.
We've been through this. I don't dislike Moonraker anymore. I like Moonraker to an extent. I'd watch it more than this film.
Do you like it more? I was going to say, do you like it more than Spectre?
Largely. Okay, let me put this out there very early on, given where you've just taken me, Terry. I think Moonraker, and this is saying something because Moonraker ends up with the most ridiculous scene in space. Moonraker holds together as a film with a plot better than Spectre does. Spectre has better hits higher notes than Moonraker at points. But if you ask me which film holds together more, it's the one where James Bond goes into space. And that's my feeling. Terry, that is my feeling. You know,
but this can't be a surprise, though, Gary, because Moonraker is objectively quite a good film.
Okay, right. So this is the point. Let's set the scene a little bit. This is the point where just come off a very hugely successful Skyfall. That's a very, very beloved film. I suspect that Terry's now got a slightly different view of it, having seen Home Alone after watching Skyfall. So, you know, probably a good thing that didn't cloud the memories of the last pod. But we get to this point, Graham, where this is the second Mendes outing. It's clear that they've got a vision. There are many, many moments which are very slick. You know, it's got the hallmarks potentially of somebody, you know, this has the hallmarks of somebody who is a, in sort of capital letters, serious filmmaker. And yet, does it all come off for you? I think you know my feelings about it.
Well, it depends on what you mean by come off. If you mean, did Sam Mendes go up to Broccoli and Wilson and say, guys, what I want to make is a brown film. Then he did it. He did it. He rocked the brown film because he's come up with a brown film. This film is so brown. It's all the browns. I mean, it doesn't skimp on the browns. All the browns are there for you. And if you're looking for a brown film, this is the brownest film ever. It's the brownest Bond. You will not find a browner Bond anywhere. This is the brown Bond film.
Except when it's yellow.
yellow, I think, is an artistic brown. I think you'll find, sorry, I think the types of yellow they're using in here are very much in the brown gamut.
Well, I'll demur to your viewpoint in that case, yeah. I mean, I must confess, I only see yellow in those yellow moments. But now that you mention it, you're right. Yellow is a family member of brown, really. No, I would say.
Yeah. I mean, like, this is the kind of film that could easily be a follow-up to Spinal Tap's Black Album. It's like, could this be any more brown? If it tried. So, Terry, even we've established it's a very brown film. We also probably established from... So this is a fascinating one, because always from the openings, you go, I think I know what type of film this is going to be. And we open in Mexico with a helicopter fight and a building being blown up and James Bond landing on a sofa in what is a sort of probably a bit of a nod to a classic Roger gag. What were your feelings after watching that, you know, that opening? Because my feeling was, I think we could be in for a real treat here.
Yeah, I was optimistic when I watched. Well, I always love watching James Bond films, even the rubbish ones. I really love watching them. The first time I ever watch a James Bond film for the first time, I love it. I just love it. And that goes for, and I have been watching films at the cinema since Spy Who Loved Me. I've been watching James Bond films at the cinema since Spy Who Loved Me, and I have enjoyed every single last one of them, including Spectre. So you can only really start to develop an opinion on these films until you've seen them two or three times. So, you know, so my initial thoughts were, you know, was that, yeah, that's a very, very encouraging opening. I mean, I had little niggles in the back of my mind about the helicopter sequence in general, which I felt was very ambitious, but at the same time, I didn't thought this is clearly. And yes, I must confess, I was thinking of Blue Thunder even then. I'm not going to lie. Blue Thunder is a film that has lived with me for a long time. And I thought, yeah, it's a bit like that bit in Blue Thunder, isn't it, really? You know, and which is now subsequently passed into Odd Job Pod lore. But I felt, no, this we're in for something of a grandstand film. This is going to be a big, you know, ambitious, blockbustery kind of, you know. I'm hoping for a pitch battle at the end of the movie. You know, maybe an underground complex. Who knows? After all, it is called Spectre. You know, it's surely, you know, maybe a volcano, maybe not a volcano or something like that, or maybe even a space station. But what we got was not quite that. Yeah, I think we got some interesting sort of like action set pieces in the film. But I would suggest, because there's some quite poignant, quite dramatic character moments in the film and character development and depth to the film. And I do wonder whether or not some of the more humorous sort of like action sequences in the film fit well. It, you know, tonally kind of, I found the film a little bit jarring as well as brown.
Well, I thought that the film completely lacked humour. Even the bits of humour that it put in there just seemed tacked on.
But I think maybe with respect to, yeah, I think it I think it had humour, but I think it was very funny.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, so that's, there was something
I think it was trying to be funny. I think you're right. I'm being cute. I think you're right, Graham. It was not funny, but I think it was trying to be. The sofa gag was kind of funny. But like the wingless, the plane car chase.
Yeah.
was an attempt to be funny in the kind of cello kind of way, ski cello kind of thing, you know, which was genuinely funny and worked really, really well. But I don't think
it's obviously funny though, isn't it?
It's nothing quite land. It just didn't land in that respect.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's I think you've actually, again, you've touched on an area which I find, which was my immediate feeling after watching this film again. And Graham, I'll go to you and get your feelings on this as well. But there are some really, really good set pieces in here. And there's some nice bits, of two-handers when you do have a bit of the script that goes right. But it's so uneven. It doesn't really hang together for me. And the best bits for me about Spectre are the set pieces. The set pieces I could watch. Some of the, you know, the conversation, you know, the face-off between Mr. White and Bond, and the bit following that up in the Hofler Clinic with Bond and Q, great fun. It then just becomes a bit, it doesn't stitch together as well for me as it could have done. You've got people who know how to do a great action sequence. You've got some people who then are clearly sat in another room doing a bit of characterization. And then you've got other people, and it doesn't feel like any of them have actually spoken to each other until they've come to stitch the whole film together.
No.
That is my feeling. I'm wondering if you violently disagree with me.
I'd agree with that. I think it looks like a Bond clip show in many respects. It just is a bunch of great scenes just knitted together, and Bond films can fall into that trap. They can fall into action sequences interspersed with talky bits, but the really good ones knit them all together in a cohesive story, rather than just say, right, now off to the next glamorous location, now off to the next big action scene. But I think you're right there. It does try to be this. It has levels of poignancy in there. I mean, I think it delivers that as soon as Judi Dench turns up. You know, or there's something serious going down. Dying wish. This is Bond on his own trying to do things. This is really serious stuff here. And then Mr. White killing himself as well. So this is all very, very real stuff. This is central characters. This is either killing off central characters or it's about the death of central characters. So you can't just like be too flippant about it. And I know I've complained about the lack of humour in it, but really you back yourself into a corner when you start doing things like that. And it's difficult to get your way out of there. So, yeah, I think that's the problem with it. When it does try and inject some humour in it, it does seem either tacked on or a bit snide. So I think that's the problem when you try to inject humour into a serious film. It doesn't sit right. And we see that all the time in action films, don't we, where you try to impose something on the top of things. But when you think when this is made and where films are, this is right in the middle of the Marvel stuff. So I wonder whether or not they're trying to distance themselves away from that sort of like Avengers strand, which is a bit of a shame because you've got Dave Bautista in there who's horrifically underused. I mean, great as an action guy, but when you see what he was doing in Guardians of the Galaxy, and of course, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy wasn't the big hit that it was then. But it's just a bit sort of disappointing. I suppose that's the thing. There is a lot of disappointment in this film.
It's a shame because you can see where they were trying to go, and you know, we'll keep on there. Terry, there's one bit that I particularly want to touch on, given that Graham's talked about Dave Bautista, who for me is actually one of the highlights of the film. Probably has one of the best lines. His only line in the film is said with a wonderful conviction. But one of the for me the cardinal sins of a Bond that gets it wrong is when it doesn't really know what to do with its villain. And that was what I felt it got with that. It had a great henchman in Hinks. You've potentially got a fantastic, you got a fantastic actor in Christoph Waltz. They're going for reviving Blofeld, which was, they were obviously trying to say, no, it's not Blofeld. Never doing it. Of course, it's Blofeld. And then it just felt like they went, right, we've got Blofeld, job done, pub. And doesn't really feel like they entirely know what to do with him. And that, to me, is one of the big problems when you've got a big bad that is just not, doesn't come across as massively bad. What do you want to do? I want to steal the data. Ah, excellent. Okay, you're going to blow anything up? No, I'm just going to steal the data. Just the data. No more than the data, just the data. Okay, I might blow a few things up, but I just want the data. Just give me the data and we'll be done with it. For me, it's always something when you're kind of your minor side plot villain, in this case Andrew Scott, who is another fantastic actor, is a bit more interesting than your main antagonist in a film. So for me, Terry, the villainy is one of the things that really lets Spectre down.
I think it suffers from the kind of two villain syndrome that I think can affect other James Bond films. I think, for example, one of the sort of criticisms of The Living Daylights is it's got the two villains that perhaps sort of don't kind of sort of like split things up a little bit, make things a bit, you're never quite certain who the real big bad is. I think this film can sometimes do that. And there was this rather poorly telegraphed, C as the new guy, clearly probably actually a villain, but we don't know that he's a villain. And the reveal for that is kind of pretty sort of like, obvious and done without any particular drama, because I think that, everybody understands that the audience probably understands that this guy is the villain, and it seemed to lack impact. Indeed, as the character for me lacks impact. I thought I was, having seen Inglourious Basterds not long beforehand and remembering Christoph Waltz's performance in that. And then when they said that they were signing him on for Spectre, and that, they were being a bit cloak and dagger about who he was going to play. And we thought, oh, well, yeah, he's going to play Blofeld and it's going to be amazing because he's an amazing actor. He's going to be a brilliant villain. And Blofeld's a great character. This film can't go wrong. And I acknowledge that part of the problem with Spectre, I think, is also because it promised so much. But didn't live up, possibly would never have lived up to everything that it was promising. But it didn't live up to that at all. I don't felt, for a film that was 2.5 hours long, he kind of only really comes in as Blofeld. Blofeld is only revealed relatively late in the film. And there's promises of chemistry between him and Bond and a development of a relationship between him and Bond that would be far more impactful and make his final scenes of the film more meaningful. But I'm afraid that I don't think there's enough work done on that relationship to really justify that and feel as though there's a payoff. I don't think that's the only issue in terms of interpersonal characters in that film either. And I think that it just feels that's disappointing given the length of the film, that there was plenty of time to develop that relationship, which I don't think that they did. And I feel that the film's B plot, or dare I say C plot, maybe took away some valuable screen time from that. And maybe that's part of the film's problem, is it overcomplicated itself.
I think another film where you've got split bad guys is Octopussy as well.
Which is a brilliant film, to be fair.
Which is a brilliant film, but they balance that well. Yeah. But also as well, it means that the end of Octopussy with where it's split between getting rid of two bad guys loses some of its impact as well. And that's probably why it's not as memorable a film as other ones in the franchise, despite it actually being a very, very, very enjoyable film.
Quite so.
I know as well. I mean, like, it always helped. And again, it's, for me, you've got two great actors in there, and yet, the impact of Octopussy's, bad guys is that they stick in the memory. And yet it's very easy, you know, these two are easy to forget. And I'll tell you one thing, Graham, Telly Savalas would never have worn Hush Puppies with no socks in the desert.
Well, if he did, he'd do it really well.
Oh, he would do it fantastically well. And again, I mean, how much do you think this is kind of burdened to an extent, Graham, by the Blofelds that have gone before? You've got Donald Pleasance, you've got Telly Savalas, who, you know, regular listeners of this pod know our feelings about Telly Savalas. You've got Charles Gray, which the less said about, probably the better in that one, unless you want to go down into Blofeld and track. And into a submarine, you'll fall. So, you know, we're going, okay, right. This is Terry said, great actor, promising a lot. And then, you know, it's not like the other villains that you've got, where you've got, you know, with probably the exception of Le Chiffre, but he's only really been in novels and in there. You've got these other screen references to come in onto here. And if you've got, if you've got an iconic character and people have a point of reference, you've got to really, really land it well. And potentially for me, that is one of the problems. It does not land it well.
Making mud pies, 007. Lower, not up.
Aren't we showing a bit more chick than usual, Tiffany?
Yes. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, yeah, I suppose that's the thing. There's always that thing though, isn't it? When this came out, that it was Spectre and it was going to be Blofeld as well. There was always the little tiny hint of fan service about the whole thing, wasn't there? So there is this, yeah. So we've got to sit through this and while they bring out all the old tropes, or update all the tropes, or try and keep some balance of updating it all and bringing our stuff back and not pissing everyone off and in the end not really telling a story or creating something that's entertaining. And I think that's the major problem with this film. I mean, there are loads of really good things in it. I love the whole Scooby Gang stuff at the end and everything like that. There are some brilliant set pieces in this. But if you sat me down and said, right, which one do you want to watch? Do you want to watch Quantum of Solace or this one? I'm going to sit and watch Quantum of Solace. Mainly because it'll be over in an hour quicker. So, yeah.
And despite the fact the plot is still a little off on there, it probably, I'm with you. It's at least. Yeah,
better story. It's got better setup. I think
it's got humour in it as well.
Well, it's more enjoyable. It's plot. Plot. Yes, absolutely. But I mean, you know, it is a well-paced film. And Spectre. Yeah, well, Graham's absolutely right to point out that there are some scenes in this movie that are some of the best cinema that the James Bond franchise has ever produced. And you know, particularly the scene composition for you know, some of the particularly early in the movie, you know, in Rome, for example. I mean, you know, we haven't discussed the tracking shot in Mexico, which is just an absolute, artistically, stylistically, is a fantastic piece of cinema and a wonderful way to start a film. And you know, it starts off, it's got the gun barrel sequence, which then fades to black, and then just that caption, "The dead are risen," and it's brilliant. And then the music kicks in and then you've got that long tracking shot and you think, gosh, man, this is a film of substance. This is a film that's going to carry through. This is clearly a film that has been thought about a lot and a lot of money's been put into it. There's a lot of artistry, a lot of technical ability. This is going to be great. And then 5 minutes later, we've got CGI helicopters doing loop-de-loops. And I think that perhaps
That's impossible.
And I think that that's a shame. I think that's the film, is you've got these incredibly impactful, visceral, powerful moments, powerful scenes. You know, Monica Bellucci, you know, standing by her husband's grave, you know, in Rome, that scene, that whole scene, and when Bond goes up to her and speaks to her, And the whole setup is absolutely immaculate. It's super dramatic. It's super clean. It's massively, massively Italian. It reeks of Italian cinema. It's a beautiful homage to great Italian cinema, and it's a great moment. And again, the next scene, the tracking scene when she goes home and she's preparing to be executed, and that whole thing, the chemistry between the two, the sex scene between the two, fantastic. Amazing character moment. Just take that whole sequence there and stick it in the Louvre. Absolutely brilliant, perfect, perfect James Bond. And yet it sits in a film that also has playing car chases. And I just, unfortunately, I just feel that it kind of, it might not jar if the film was just a little less baggy and maybe had a bit more energy to it. And maybe if some of the action sequences meant a bit more. I mean, I swear that sequence had my pulse racing a lot more than a lot of the action sequences in the film, including like the car chase through Rome, which just looked like, what happens when you finish a race in Gran Turismo. It just didn't, there was no energy to that, nothing to get the pulse racing at all.
Well, you know why? Because that scene going through the villa was a piece of music that's a few hundred years old, whereas the rest of it is by some
Thomas
guy.
Newman.
Yeah. And Thomas Newman just does not do good Bond soundtracks. I don't care. He just doesn't.
That's a hill that you're willing to die on, Graham.
Yeah, basically, yeah. But Terry's right about that opening sequence. It goes from Soy Cabano to Blue Thunder. I mean, that's only a Bond film can do that, can't it, really?
Yeah, and he doesn't put it off, though, unfortunately. I think that's the thing. It's very difficult to know how that they do manage to pull these things off, but they don't in that. But I think ultimately what it comes down to is that the Daniel Craig series of films are serious films, and it's very difficult therefore to bring any slapstick or shall we say excessive fantasy and indeed sight gags into these kind of films, because tonally they're not welcome in these films. And I think that's why they had difficulty with this one pacing it. It's a lesson that I think they learned in No Time to Die, incidentally, which is a much better film. And I think even though it goes on for even longer, but I think it's a lesson that they learned there. It's just it's disappointing. Every time I watch Spectre, I'm disappointed because there's some elements of it I'm just utterly blown away by, but it just doesn't hang together, sadly. It is not a film that is greater than the sum of its parts, alas.
Mm.
It is a real shame, because you have so many bits which give promise within that. And just on the one of the things that I was really thinking of, and I'm glad you brought up the Monica Bellucci sequence, was that in another world they would have actually gone down the route of just going, right, we're going to have Monica Bellucci as the Bond girl. You could have a really cracking, plot line there. The idea of, she's clearly a character of interest and substance, even in the short time she has on screen. Also, I would be very happy to have more Monica Bellucci on screen as well. But I felt like at that point I was watching going, you could have taken this film in a not totally different direction, but you could have taken this film in a way with the characterization that I think would have been much more interesting. It's not that I dislike Lea Seydoux. I think she's, she does well enough with a part that I think is a little bit, again, undercooked. But, anything that's undercooked there is probably forgiven a lot more when it comes to No Time to Die for me, albeit having the caveat of only having seen that film once still. But yeah, there's bits which you would like to take and you'd like to rearrange and make your own Bond film out of some of the best bits of it. It's a shame when you kind of just like, there's bits you want to cut and cut up and then put your own bits around it. So essentially, what I'm saying is that I'd probably, while they're cosplaying being Roger Moore in a serious film, I would just quite like to be writing some Bond fanfic with Monica Bellucci and then doing my own film off the back of that is my hot take from that. Such a shame because there's promise. For me, Graham, it kind of starts on a high and then just slowly that But that scene there in just before the car chase in Rome is probably the high point. And it just kind of slowly, and it's not even like it quickly drops off, like Die Another Day does when Madonna turns up. It just kind of gradually, very slowly, with a lot of Brown, with a lot of Sam Mendes in there, just gradually starts dropping to the point where, you know, I was engaged, and then the point where you suddenly get to Blofeld's there, my brain just went, oh, I've gone now. And I remember I've done that since I've watched Spectre at cinema when I thought it was the best Bond film ever, because that's obligatory. I've realised every single time I get to Blofeld's there, my brain just goes, oh, I've done that. Switched out for most of the rest of this.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you look at the way they arrive there, then, you know, they're waiting at a disused train station, waiting for a car to turn up to take them to the lair. It's not how you want to arrive at a lair, isn't it? Where people are, like, checking your luggage in and you're handing things over at reception, aren't you? And then you get taken to a big room and look at a big rock. There's nothing about that lair that is exciting. It's intriguing. And yes, of course, all right. I mean, Ken Adams will look at that and think, did I do nothing here? Look, did I not leave notes? I'm sure I left some notes here.
My oil rig is better than this.
Yeah, even my oil rig. I mean, you've basically gone to what looks like a water treatment works.
Yeah, it's a very highly, highly flammable water treatment
extremely works. Flammable water treatment works. This lair is even worse than the one in Quantum of Solace, and that was just a hotel.
Yeah, I mean, in fairness,
an extremely flammable hotel.
Was a hotel. It was an in-universe hotel as well as being an actual hotel, so we can forgive that. I mean, obviously, health and safety is not an issue at Spectre. It is governed by the fact that Dave Bautista's suit caught fire so alarmingly quickly as well during the train fire. Oh, bloody hell! What's in that acrylic? I think I can appreciate Mendes's an attempt at the inevitability of Blofeld and the inevitability of the confrontation by setting it up in such a way as to say, well, we're going to drop him off an abandoned station and wait for a Rolls Royce to come and pick them up. And I think that I can respect that artistic choice as being, you know, part of this film. But unfortunately, it lends itself to accusations that the film in other areas is just a by-the-numbers James Bond film.
Yeah.
And it has an inevitability which makes it predictable. And I think that that's where, unfortunately, that trick doesn't work, sadly. And it kind of backfires because it just like means we all know what's going to happen in this film. We may not know the absolute particulars, but there's zero suspense going on. And towards the end, in fact, it becomes quite irritating because you're kind of thinking, well, this, why don't we just literally cut to the chase here so that we can just like or go home, because it's kind of, I've got a podcast to record in 15 minutes. It's, you know, and it was, I mean, the final sequences, for example, in the old MI5 building, and I get this, and I understand the symbolism, but it's completely overplayed, and it's just not necessary, and it's so obviously retconned as well. So that is sort of, you know, it was me, James, the architect of your pain. Says, no, it wasn't. You won your legal battle, and now you can use this character again, and now you're trying to retcon him back into the previous movies that were actually quite good. And I think that things like that are just disappointing about the film. And yet, as I said, I mean, it's got some truly glorious moments in it.
Yeah, it's so we've talked a lot, and I think about what we don't like. Terry's touched on one bit which I would agree with is superb. Graham, is there elements that you take from it that you do like, or is this just, you know, has it just done too much to really make this a wholly enjoyable Bond experience for you?
Well, there is lots of lovely stuff in there, but I don't know if it's lovely stuff because it just tickles the parts of my brain that send out serotonin when I see like a ski chase or a train fight. Probably a train fight. Having a train fight in a Bond film, of course, and a really good train fight as well. They do very, very, very well there. And so that's lovely. But then again, there's also the cynical side of me that says, yeah, you're just doing this because you know I like it. You know that you're just feeding me stuff that you know, this is just me doom scrolling a Bond film, isn't it?
It's like the foie gras of Bond film. You are the goose and or duck, and you're just being
well.
Spent
I mean,
stuff.
I think that's okay. What do we think of the torture scene? Because that is entirely lifted from Colonel Sun, even some of the dialogue. Do we think they just wanted to put that in there? Because that's all part of that denouement at Blofeld's, I shall say, lair. But it's this like big white room they've got suddenly in this water treatment works that also has this room that looks like a poor version of the control room from Moonraker. Moonraker did it better again.
Right, Ken Adam.
Yeah,
Ken Adam did it better. I mean, Dr. No's lair was better laid out, albeit, you know, not as well executed, obviously. I think that that's a very disappointing torture sequence because I think it's too clinical.
Mm.
And I don't think that the audience can wrap their head around the science necessarily of what they're trying to do. And he's doing torture expositionary dialogue, trying to explain to the audience why what he's doing is beastly. And it's nothing beats, cutting out the seat of a chair and putting a naked man underneath it and then attacking his swingers with a rope. That's a torture scene. But I think that kind of gives us a great example of the difference between a really well put together James Bond film like Casino Royale, which has a relationship between Bond and the villain that is patiently developed over the course of the film and then culminates in the torture scene, and Spectre, which has a poorly developed relationship and a rather clinical, not unrealistic, but unemotional torture scene at the end. And I think it sums up the difference between the two films quite well, actually, and why one is an absolute classic and the other is something of a disappointment, albeit a beautifully assembled disappointment.
Mm. How much, Graham, do you think it kind of got away with stuff by the fact it is, you know, it is a beautifully shot film? It's clearly trying to be serious. Do you think that kind of probably maybe buys it, or in some people's minds has bought it a little more and they're not necessarily looking in the depth that we are? Or is this just a film which, you know, most people see through and go, yeah, you know what, this is just like, you know, A View to a Kill with a better budget and worse script writing?
I don't think you're that far off it really there, really, with A View to a Kill, that sort of level. But at least A View to a Kill has some laughs along the way. Genuine laughs. So, yeah, I think you're right. I think because they put a load of money into this and they recouped it all because it was a very, very, very popular film. But, it's an expensively put together film, which, I don't know. I mean, maybe it does do exactly what they wanted it to do. I mean, it kept the franchise alive. They got another film out of it. No Time to Die was due to come out, what, just 4 years afterwards. It took a little longer because COVID and everything. But yeah. I mean, it everything about the Spectre. I mean, the more you look at it, I mean, I would say is if you want to enjoy a Bond film, the last thing you want to do is look closely at it. And this is very much the case with Spectre. You don't want to look closely at this film because it's not like you're going to see the joins or anything like that, because it's a really well put together film. But it's just the fact that when you see films that were made, films in the franchise that were made for, like, you know, next to nothing and just chucked together and because they had problems from day one, and then you look at a film like this which didn't have any of those problems, had everything going for it, and then but they still messed it up when there's no excuse for it, And that's disappointing. That's what's really disappointing about it, I think.
Yeah, for me, I mean, it's odd to sort of bring the comparison with Spectre, which is such a kind of grand spectacle overall. And then, you know, I think of some of those films, that, you know, reference For Your Eyes Only. I would much rather sit down and watch For Your Eyes Only than I would Spectre. I think it has, you know, a bit more funny. In fact, generally, I think I'd rather sit down and watch most Roger Moore films, with the exception of The Man with the Golden Gun, which is not a good film, than before I watched Spectre. But it's, yeah, Terry, I mean, I feel like as we've gone on, we just feel the overarching theme here, as well as being brown, is just wasted opportunity.
Yeah. I mean, can I say, I do, before I answer your question, I mean, there's elements of the brown that I really, really like. There's, I mean, they go to Rules, for example, which is a restaurant that I keep meaning to go to myself. When, you know, that there's clearly, you know, I think, you know, that there's a, I think the brown means something. I think it's symbolic. I think they're trying to say something about the brown. And I feel it's a kind of, the idea of a brown represents perhaps age, and aging tastes, aging fashions, and that kind of clash between sort of the brown of the old and the traditional, and the more higher energy that you get with like C's building and with Blofeld's lair, at least the interiors thereof. And so I can kind of get. I think I get that. I think I understand what's happening there. I just feel that symbolism isn't necessarily something you go to when you go to see a James Bond film, or at least it does. But you've got to have the rest of it's got to be right as well. You know, you got to the whole, you know, let's have fun watching an action film thing has got to be right. But sorry, what was the question? I got lost in brown there for a moment.
It's easy to get lost in the brown, isn't it?
I think the relationship, I think, between Bond and Madeline, I'm afraid, also for me, doesn't develop quickly. It doesn't develop enough to be able to, for me to be able to fully. I don't really feel and believe the depth of emotion that they have and the depth of their relationship, I'm afraid, by the end of the film. I think it moves. I think there's a lot of animosity between the two of them, understandably. The scene in L'Américain, I think, is fantastic, and I love the tension there, and I love the and I can appreciate the fact that there is the attraction building between the two of them during that time. But I still am not. I think there was too much adrenaline in that relationship. I think for it to be that considered, and I'm just not convinced by that, and I'm not altogether certain that Craig and Lea Seydoux have that chemistry in the film. I'm afraid to say, I'm a bit baffled by some of the choices that Madeleine Swann makes, particularly at the very end when she decides to just like walk off into the London night on her own. And that for me just feels like, well, that's like all gets a bit clunky to me, and I'm just not really buying that. I mean, this film relies so much on these character moments, and so it's really important that they get them right. And in some instances, they get them really, really right. And in other instances, I'm afraid they don't. And the key relationships are obviously James Bond and his relationship with the villain and with the Bond girl. And alas, I don't think that either of those is as well done as it could have been, given the quality of the actors.
Mm.
One of the things, and actually I think you've touched on something which is what I felt all the way throughout, is that I think when they know what they're doing, when they get stuck into the detail of stuff, and again, it feels almost like the familiar ground they are very good with. And the bits where they've kind of got to deal with, you know, inconvenient things such as plot and characterization of new characters, it's done in such broad brushstrokes that, very pretty looking broad brushstrokes, but they're so broad that, you know, and we've looked at the Bond films, or pretty much all the Bond films, in more detail than they probably deserve. And yet we will normally come out, even some of the bad films, more the ones that we're not quite so fond of. By and large, there's stuff where you can see it hangs together. And this, I don't know whether they underthought it because they just went, hey, way, good idea. Or they just went, they overthought it and spent far too long trying to work out what they were doing there, that they just and probably had too many opinions. It just ended up nothing. I don't know what went on in that room there, but when they knew what they were doing, they knew what they're doing. When they didn't, they just went, done, right, fine, Graham.
Well, I think if you look at it, you've got to think, well, we can't just remake Casino Royale. I mean, that's always got to be in the back of their head. They can't just say, right, okay, we can't just bring on Christoph Waltz to be an ersatz Le Chiffre. We can't just bring Léa Seydoux in to be another version of Vespa, even though that's what they really need them to be. But the things with Casino Royale, you've got the relationship with Bond and Vespa is allowed to mature in a very, very natural way. And they go through shit together. And they go through some really, really, really heavy shit together. And also, as well, there is the underlying tone of the fact that she's a double agent in there as well, which is fantastically crafted. And then you've got Le Chiffre, played by Mads Mikkelsen, and you know he's a bad guy, but you know also as well he's desperate as well, which adds a whole dimension to him. You don't see, there's not another bad guy in the Bond franchise that is as developed as Mikkelsen's Le Chiffre, and it works so well. So what do you do when you get someone like Christoph Waltz at the peak of his powers at this point, by the way? You don't normally get villains who are this much this high profile, and yeah, what do? You introduce him halfway through a film, and all of it just does not work very well. I mean, maybe if you are deliberately not trying to make Casino Royale, then yeah, okay, you're really, really going to struggle to make a really, really good, memorable Bond film. And in the end, you come up with a film that's like Living Daylights, like Octopussy, which has got these things going all over the place that doesn't really match up. There's no real thread that really binds it all together. And all the characters in there aren't allowed to develop. They're not allowed to. You're not allowed to really, really pull them in and either generate true revulsion for them or really true love for them either.
So true. So true. There's so not enough time to have any sympathy or affection for the characters. The audience is not engaged emotionally with these characters and doesn't really mind what happens to them.
Yeah, that's where it kind of got, you care about Mr. White to a bit because you've seen that develop throughout the previous films. In just a few, so about 10 minutes, you certainly care and get invested in Monica Bellucci's character. You care about the Scooby Gang. Everything, those are the bits when, and you can tell when they've got that little bit of fleshed out characterization there, generally with people who've either been before or they've just written minor characters really in such a way that are so well developed. It's a huge, huge shame when you get there. So look, I think we need to wrap up, not least because I have to. I've got child duties on in a minute, which probably also involves some form of brown as well, I'm sure.
Ew.
But Terry, I mean, one thing I just want to bring in terms of summing up, like, I think we all know our feelings on this film. I'm curious as to kind of where you place this overall, like, we're not doing the kind of whole ranking from what one to the end here, but where would you put this? Because I we talked about Octopussy and Living Daylights and Fear Eyes Only. For me, it's much below those ones. Where does it sit for you?
It's on a technical level, it's one of the best crafted James Bond films that's ever been made. But in terms of the artistry, the design, the cinematography, apart from the piss filters in Mexico and Tangier, they really, really made me annoyed. As a technical piece of work, it's a marvel. It's a wonderful thing. It's a great spectacle. Turn the volume down and put some music on, maybe some John Barry, and I think it's going to be a wonderful background. But unfortunately, it lacks the substance, I think, to be one of the greats. And yeah, there are cheaper Bond movies that have been made, technically, probably speaking, worse James Bond movies that have been made that are more watchable, have better plots, better characterization, I think. So I don't know where I put that. I don't know that. I'm afraid that doesn't really answer in terms of ranking. I don't know, but it ranks poorly, Spectre, sadly. It ranks poorly. The only redeeming quality is at the very, very end, almost the very, very end, when Bond is on Westminster Bridge, choosing which direction to take his life, he chooses Lambeth and South London.
He's going off to the pineapple, Northern. Isn't he?
He's what?
He's going to the pineapple, isn't he?
Yeah, he's off to the pineapple, where there's going to be a lock-in.
Yeah.
Why?
I mean, he's post-midnight, but I reckon he could get in there.
Oh, I reckon he'll get into the pineapple. No bother. No bother.
Easily. Graham, where does this film sit for you?
It sits in a waiting room, waiting for a long time, waiting for a 1949 Silver Wraith to come pick it up. That's where it sits for me. The thing is, I will revisit this film over and over again for however long I keep watching Bond films for. But that's because it sits in between No Time to Die and Skyfall. I do like the Craig era films. I do like them. I like what they did with the character. I like what they did with the extended cast as well. And I think this, as far as the Scooby Gang is concerned, this is the weakest of the films, because they get it right again in No Time to Die. They got it right in Skyfall, and they didn't get it right in this one. It's just they're just people that are just on the periphery. Which is another thing as well. Another thing as well, it's like, in the previous film, it's like they were saying things like, oh, yeah, were you expecting an exploding pen? We don't really go in for that. This time they go, all right, quick, have an exploding watch, by the way. It's, yeah, quick, let's, yeah. I want to talk about retconning, then yeah, here we go. And I think that's probably the most annoying thing about it is that, yeah, it tries to pull the wool over your eyes, as Terry said, retconning its way, saying, oh, this was the grand design all the time. No, it wasn't, for God's sake. We all know that. Come up with an original idea. You can do. It's there for you.
Yeah.
You don't have to think about these sort of overarching things.
Or just rip off Casino Royale. I mean, like... You know, you point out quite rightly, Graham, while they didn't want to rip off Casino Royale. Well, why? I mean, they've ripped off Goldfinger enough times. Why not? Go back to the well, you know, just who cares?
or just rewrite one of the other films. I mean, we rebooted Moonraker. It. Yeah, no, why not? I mean, well, all right, they actually did Moonraker, didn't they, in Die Another Day, didn't they?
That's true.
So... Yeah. I only found out the other day that they were going to call Miranda Frost Gala Brand, and there was a last minute thing in there that they renamed her.
Interesting.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Cause it is because like they made her a baddie in it. So it's yeah. Very interesting. But yeah, I only say this because I recently reread. This year I'm. Rereading all of the Fleming novels.
Nice.
So I went onto eBay on January and I bought myself a collection of all the 14, all the 12 novels and the two collections of short stories. So I'm working my way through them. I've just finished Diamonds Are Forever. I'm just about a third of the way through From Russia with Love. So yes.
What a book. Oh, man alive.
Get my hands on some of them and do a podcast on the books, because I feel that's been missing probably from the time we've been doing it. And, and I think it'd probably be more enjoyable than Spectre. It's a shame. And I think, look, if you have a different opinion, please, you know, you can tell us. I don't think we would feel, you know, if you came out and said, I really like this film, I wouldn't necessarily go, you're totally wrong. I can see why some people might, but I'm, you know, for me, yeah, not enough. And I think, you know, if there's one big takeout, it's let's just watch the Monica Bellucci sequences over and over again, and we'll be very, very happy with that. And we can put our own idea of where we want the film to go off the back of that. But yes, that was the slightly underwhelming Spectre, I think. I mean, I'd have satisfied being whelmed with that rather than underwhelmed. But it didn't really reach levels of being whelming, particularly all the way through. But we do have two crackers coming up. We've got obviously No Time to Die, which we're going to be looking at. And I think that that will be an interesting one to be revisiting, because with the luster of a new James Bond film will have worn off. And I'm very much looking forward to going back into that one. And before then, we have Odd Job Pod and my pick of The Running Man as well, of which I am incredibly excited. Those are two movies which set the pulse racing about the same level as Bond and Monica Bellucci, really, as opposed to a sewage work, treatment work being blown up, which, you know, and also like a demolition site as well. Your two big set pieces are in sewage work and a demolition site. I mean, you know, that tells you all you need to know. As I say, this is the film that it just basically, you know, takes Ken Adams' legacy and puts Brown on it. It's very disappointing. Anyway, thank you very much for sticking with us through Spectre. You can tell the slight air of disappointment that comes all the way through, which, you know, is probably fair. Gents, are you looking forward to the next two? You're looking forward to the next two more than Spectre?
Oh, totally, totally. Yeah, I mean, we've got two excellent films to come. And two really, really enjoyable films. Two films that we will want to talk about for longer than an hour anyway.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
My fault for this. I completely did a Dave Bautista with a rope around its neck, dragged out with my timings on this one. Shit.
I think you've spared us, though, to be fair.
Really, so
I think it's actually works. Yeah, no, I think we should be spending some serious quality time with No Time to Die. And certainly with The Running Man, I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah,
absolutely. And I think actually, dear listener, we spared you as well. So if anything, if you've got this part, you should be thanking us. And then do that by just rating the podcast nicely. Go to subscribe if you don't already on any of the places you get your podcasts. You can like us on any of the social networks, which I don't know where they're at the moment, but social media is social media. Elon Musk's probably working on his own sewage works, as we think right now.
But it'll be great to hear from big Spectre stands out there as well.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, if you've been fuming for the last hour our takes, our very loose, very sort of like, brown takes, then and you may be a massive fan of the brown. Which is fine. That's fine. That's your personal choice. I'm not going to knock that at all. If you like the brown's okay with me. Well, not okay with me. It's okay with you. But please let us know why you like this brown film.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And yes, Spectre.
For God's sake, man, finish the podcast. Hi, Sandra.
How are you?
Very good, thank you. Yes.
Soon as he finishes, we'll go.
Yes.
Yes.
We promise.
Well, it's up to you, Gary. Case,
it remains for me to say, wherever Spectre stands at, come and enjoy and tell us your opinion. Thank you to Terry DeFellin. Thank you to Graham Sibley. Thank you, dear listener, for sitting and watching through Spectre and listening to us for an hour on Spectre. Until then, goodbye.
Goodbye.
I'll be back.
As you can gather, I need to be
going
out the door for my child. But that was fun.
Yeah,
I enjoyed that.
Yeah,
that I want to go back and watch Blue Thunder now after.
Therapeutic. Yeah.
That's impossible.
That's impossible. All right. I will see you guys soon. We'll arrange Running Man next, which I am so stoked.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.